Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld.
This episode is produced in cooperation with Independent Art Fair New York City. It will be part of the fair's 2023 OVR.
I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality.
Episode 78, recorded March 8, 2023. My guest for this special Independent Art Fair episode is Nina Johnson, who runs her eponymous gallery in Miami since more than 15 years. Hi, Nina. Very happy to have you.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, good afternoon from here. Nina, you've been born and raised in Miami in a time when the city was really far away from becoming an international art hub. And I wanted to ask you, how did you grow up? What were your early influences that brought you ultimately into the art world?
So I was born and raised in Miami, in a very different city than it is today. You know, I didn't grow up in an art household, but I grew up in a very supportive one. So whatever we were interested in is what my parents got themselves interested in along the way. And, you know, I was always sort of a collector. I was always somebody that was interested in aesthetics. My mother and I, when I was a child, we used to collect antique dolls. You know, I was sort of like the strange little 10-year-old that would come into the antique fair booth and say to them, oh, can I take the wig off and look at the markings? And sort of, I was fascinated, I think, because Miami, at least what I knew of it at the time, felt like such a new city. Mm. I was fascinated by objects that carried such an intense history.
Oh, so they were charged with history.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's really what led me to art. You know, when I was in high school, I started making art and I just became really invested in that side of my studies and had a very supportive art teacher who cultivated that for me. She gave me this little closet that was like my own studio. And, you know, I was really lucky in that way. So even though at the time there was no Perez Art Museum, no ICA Miami, no Art Basel, none of that here, I felt really supported. And when I was around 15, which is here, you know, in the States, around the age when you start thinking about where you're going to go to university and what are you going to study, I wanted to study art, but the school that I went to had very little reference for where to send me. And at the time, you know, art just wasn't a popular thing.
Yes, I remember.
You know, it was like niche, and they would say to you, oh, good, another starving artist, you know, whatever. There was none of that. And I was lucky because a friend of my family's was married to a woman who was then the art critic for the Miami Herald. Her name was Lisa Turner. Mm-hmm. And he said to my father, you know, have Nina call Elisa and maybe she can give her some guidance. And so Elisa said to me at the time, well, you can go and do this thing called an internship and you work for free. And I said, well, where do I go? Where do I do that? You know? And Elisa pointed me in the direction of two different organizations. One was Locust Projects, which had just started and was very scrappy and in a very rough neighborhood. And the other was a woman named Bernice Steinbaum, who was truly a pioneering dealer in New York in the 80s. She showed what at the time she referred to as artists who were women and persons of color.
Very cutting edge at that time.
Really wild. And she had sort of semi-retired in Miami. I mean, she had a gallery here, but the idea was that her children and her grandchildren were here. And you know, I was so lucky to land in her lap because at her core, she was an educator, you know, and even though at the time, this was like late 90s, early 2000s, the idea of the artists that she was showing were sort of out of favor, you know, but for me, it was fascinating because we were looking at Pepone Osorio. We were looking at Faith Ringgold, Jean Quick to C. Smith, Beverly Buchanan, Hung Lu, artists that now have had a really resurgent interest in their practice. But, you know, their work was about storytelling. And so it really resonated with me, having had this background interest in antiques.
Yes, you are interested in the history and in the charging of the objects. And also what I find is, like, never underestimate the power of the right teacher, the power of elders, of educators. You know, how important they are sometimes, if they open up doors for us.
I mean, for me, that was truly, you know, it was my education. When I first came to Bernice, I said to her, you know, I was 15, which is very young.
It's very young.
And I said, I want to be an artist and an art dealer. And she said, it was my first day. And she goes, well, I got news for you, baby. She used to call everyone baby. You got to pick. You're going to be one or the other, or you're going to be not very good at both.
And so, well, she's right.
And she was so right. You know, it was through my time with Bernice, and I just met the most incredible people. Like, Deborah Willis would come to do a show, and I would get to drive her to the airport.
And then you were 16 already, huh?
And then I was 16. And it was like the years went on. And by the time I left to college, I ended up going to a very sort of conceptually minded art school. And the reason was because by then I knew I wanted to be a dealer. And I knew what I needed to do that well was a deeper understanding of the way artists make work. I did not want an art history degree. I didn't want to be looking back at them as these sort of rarefied makers of things. I didn't want a business degree.
I think you're really right to look for where it comes from the artist side. But being a dealer also means doing business. So doing a business degree was just not in your interest.
You know, I felt that I had come from an entrepreneurial family, and I felt as though I could get the business teaching elsewhere. I had gotten so much from Bernice, and I sort of knew from being surrounded by people, everyone in my immediate family, and then every person on my maternal side of the family is a business owner. I just felt like, we joke, we say it's our Arab roots because they grew up in Guatemala, but they were Lebanese kind of going back. And that side of it was a little bit more natural to me.
So dealing is in your DNA.
It's in my DNA. Yeah, we're always at the market somehow, you know.
And then you decided to stay in Miami. So what is so particular about that place, about the energy, and what does it require to run a gallery from that particular place?
So this was an interesting thing, because having grown up here, if you had asked that 15-year-old me if I would end up living in Miami, I would have said, absolutely not, never, no way. The city that I grew up in wasn't one that valued culture, at least not in a way that was obvious to me. Mm-hmm. So I was always looking for ways to go. You know, when I was in high school, I would do these, lucky enough to do these summer programs where I would go and spend a summer going to school at Parsons in New York, and then go and spend a summer in Paris going to art school there. And I just wanted what wasn't immediately available to me. So eventually I left. I went to school in Boston. I spent some time working in New York. And right around when that was happening, Art Basel came to Miami. And essentially, by the time I graduated school, my husband, who then was my boyfriend, and I, we got on Craigslist, which is a little bit of dating ourselves, but that's when you would find Craigslist apartments. Like, and we looked at what would it cost for us to live in New York? What would it cost for us to live in Boston? And what would it cost for us to live in Miami? And for the same amount of money in Miami, we could have a two-bedroom house with a garage that he could use as his studio. And, you know, at the same time, we just felt like this huge thing of Art Basel was happening in the city. The museums were expanding. By then, MoCA was a well-established museum here. You know, the Miami Art Museum was doing interesting things. And it seemed as though we could come here and actually make a difference.
The energy came to Miami suddenly.
Exactly. It just was like, oh, this place that I had taken for granted and overlooked seemed to hold so much opportunity. And so we came back and I went back to work for Bernice, this time as assistant director. And I was there for 2 years. I curated my first show there. And then I felt, okay, it's time to jump off and do something on my own.
And how old were you then?
I was very young. I was, when I opened the gallery, I was 23. I just didn't know any better.
Did you feel it made a difference also not only being young, but also being a young woman?
Absolutely. And I think in some ways that was, I had learned from women, you know, my mother was a business owner, my grandmother, my aunt, having worked with Bernice, then, you know, when I was in school in Boston, Anne Craven, whose work now we show, she was my teacher. And then eventually I went to work for her in New York and also her then dealer, which was Tanya at Gasser and Gruner. Mm-hmm. And so I had always been surrounded by women. And to me, it seemed not an anomaly. It seemed actually, this is a world, even historically, looking back at people like Peggy Guggenheim and Ileana Sonneben. Oh, this is a world for women. It wasn't until I got into it a few years and realized, oh, look at this. There's all these men that we're sort of up against. And, you know, there's.
That is so weird because I can absolutely feel the same way that you think, like, yeah, it's a women's world until you enter a certain kind of world. And then you think, like, ooh, what's going on here? And I find it particularly interesting because women, if their power is unleashed, they are just so powerful.
Absolutely. And I think there's a little bit of that. The naive quality is kind of a requirement when you start any business, right? It's like you have to be a little bit blind to the realities of it or you would never do it.
And that's true.
I will also say I was fortunate because I was so young. Well, I was certainly met with people who dismissed me or weren't interested in what I was doing. I was also met with people who really were supportive, like Dennis Scholl, who at the time, him and his wife, Deborah, had world-class boxing. It was an exhibition space to house their collection less than a block away from the gallery. They would always come to the space and offer advice and make suggestions and bring friends. Paul Berg and his wife, Estelle, who are Miami-based collectors, really felt, hey, look at this young woman doing an interesting thing. Maybe it's not the most resolved, but she's doing it. So let's support it.
Yeah, I think the beginner's spirit is, as you said, it can lead you very far because you don't fear, you know, you just jump into it. And then if you're like super established, it's also becoming easier because you've been there for such long. But all these intermediate years, how to deal with them, because they can be sometimes not so easy.
You know, I remember an early anecdote. Mark Coetzee, who was then the director of the Rubel, then it was the collection, not the museum, came in the gallery. We had been open maybe a year or two, and we had a show up by a South African artist named Bridget Baker, a video artist. And Mark came in, and I was so thrilled, young dealer, big deal. And I was walking him around the show, and he was always, from that point on, very supportive. And he said, are you making any money? Which, of course, I was not, you know? And I just said, of course, we're doing great. He's sort of like, What are you going to say?
You have to fake it until you make it.
Exactly. And he said, oh, well, good for you. Because, you know, it really takes at least 5 years for a gallery to be in the green. And, you know, I'm sure he could tell I was lying through my teeth. It was being very generous with me. And he said, you know, most businesses have this tremendous upfront investment. But with a gallery, the investment is your time and just showing the community that you're not a flash in the pan, that you're going to be there. And he was so right. You know, that sort of advice, that veiled advice was a gift that I never forgot.
But how do art fairs play into that? Because all of the art fairs were funded to support the galleries, to make better business, to make their artists more visible. But they have become so expensive. It is such an investment that sometimes the opposite happens. So how important is that for you? I mean, you said Art Basel changed the game in Miami, but how do you develop with art fairs?
You know, I think it's a old school saying, but it's one that works in this context, everything in moderation. When we first opened the gallery, of course, even had we wanted to do an art fair, who would want us, you know? Yeah. So we didn't, and it didn't become part of our model because we just said, okay, they don't want us. We're doing these applications. We're spending all this time investing here. And it's always denied, 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 right? So we just said we have to learn how to survive on our own.
That's not so bad, actually.
It was an incredible thing to say, okay, how am I going to get people through the doors of the gallery? How am I going to make myself known while there's an art fair happening somewhere if I'm not part of it? What are the relationships that we can build? You know, everyone talks about you do an art fair. Oh, you meet so many people. The museums come in, all of this. But actually, what happens if you travel, if you take the time to take a weekend, go to that regional museum that you're trying to build a relationship with, spend some time with the curator, look at what they're doing. This forms a much more in-depth dialogue than the 10 minutes you might spend with somebody in your booth at a fair. I think what happened over time is we were able to be much more selective and strategic about the art fairs that we wanted to participate in, and then really say to ourselves, if we're going to be doing this fair, why are we doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Who are the particular audiences that we're trying to target, and for what artists? And that's the way we approach it now, where we have a much more selective process through which we decide to do fairs. We really try hard not to give in to keeping up with the Joneses and saying, oh, all of our friends are doing this fair, so we should do it too, you know?
Yeah, it's not so easy to stay true to your own agenda sometimes. I want to go back to what you said, that you took the effort then to travel and to meet all these people personally. And were you welcome? Did they open up the doors willingly?
I would say sometimes yes and sometimes no, you know, and that's also how you find your people, right? I always say this with clients, it's a self-selecting process. People will say to me, oh, you seem to have so many women, you know, come to a gallery dinner, there's so many women that support the gallery, or you really don't have a lot of people who are buying this sort of idea of like flipping or doing whatever. It's like, yeah, because we don't speak the same language as those clients. And I found that to be the case with curatorial relationships as well. There's a personality to the program. And at first you might feel like, oh, this curator isn't giving me the time of day and I've been banging down their door. Eventually, over time, you sort of see, well, it makes sense, right? Because nothing I'm showing is what they're interested in. Why am I banging down their door just because they're on the list of top 10 curators to watch right now? That's not a very effective way to do business.
Mm.
So I think that's something that I've really invested a lot of time in, is trying to finding our people in all aspects of it.
One of your artists said that you have the ability to make people see what you see.
That's so nice.
So if you're really into something, you obviously can kind of like get it over to the people so they understand what you see. Do you have any idea how you do that?
I believe that enthusiasm is contagious. And I think oftentimes when you asked earlier about why not a business degree, there are decisions that I could have made throughout my career for business purposes,
mm-hmm.
artists that I could have shown or relationships I could have held on to. But if the enthusiasm for the work is lacking and it only exists because of the financial gain or the sort of what it's going to get you in terms of your reputation and that sort of thing, how can I possibly sell that to somebody? you know, that's when the conversation becomes diluted. I think when people physically come into this gallery, myself, my staff, we're really excited, invested, engaged with the artists that we're showing. And I think it's hard for the audience not to connect with that, you know?
Mm-hmm. I feel that spaces are very, very influential, how we present work, how the artists display exhibitions, et cetera, et cetera. So how does the feel of the space and its dimension add to the whole thing?
I think it's critical. I think that for the first 7 years of the life of the gallery, we were in a warehouse in Wynwood. It was a nondescript warehouse. We loved our landlords. We probably stayed longer than we should have because we had such a good relationship with them. But there was no character. You know, once you were inside the four walls of the gallery, you could have been in any city in the world.
Oh, I see.
And when I started to look for, at that, the time that we left that space, it was clear to me that we would always be based in Miami. And I wanted to buy our next space. And I spent a lot of time looking at cities where I felt that the galleries had a very particular sense of place. The city that I think does this better than anyone is Mexico City. If you stand inside of Query Manzuto's space in Mexico City, you could not be anywhere else in the world, you know, like you can feel it in the architecture. You look out of the windows, you know where you are. And so I wanted a space that felt like Miami. Why were we just copying the architecture that worked in other cities?
Wow.
It felt like Miami has wonderful light. We have beautiful weather. We have wonderful greenery that grows here. But we also are a city with a lot of complexities. And the space that we ended up in, and subsequently the architects that we chose to work with to renovate it with us, is a space that feels a little bit grungy. We're in the middle of Little Haiti, which is a longstanding immigrant neighborhood. We have a mango tree, an avocado tree, a big oak tree. There's an old sugarcane crank in the backyard. We have glass block, which is very, you know, Miami Vice 1980s. And these are all things that were here. And it felt like we didn't want you to feel like you were in a luxury, you know, at the Four Seasons. We wanted you to feel like you were in an art space in Little Haiti.
In a real space.
A real space. A real space.
Galleries around the world, especially big ones, tend to look very similar. Mm-hmm. And I find that a very, very interesting concept to be thought of, that we have to address the place where we are much more. Would that be an advice you would give to a young gallerist?
Absolutely. I think particularly now when so much of our business is image driven, mm-hmm. it's important when you see those images to know where they are. You know, I mean, if not, it could just be an online viewing room, right? Like we want people to, whether they're, let's say you're in New York and you get a catalog from one of our shows, there is a sort of aspirational feeling to looking at the images and going, you know, like we were joking at the beginning of this call, it's so cold where you are, it's so warm where I am. I want people to be looking through that catalog wherever they are and remember the time that we were physically here together. I think that that's a very important thing for our model. You know, I think there are certain galleries that want to operate with more anonymity, I guess would be the word, and a little bit more where the gallery itself has less of a personality. I think that's fine, but it's not the way we've developed the program.
Yeah, it's not how you work. You also said in one of the interviews that you're interested in the 30-year game.
Yes.
So that you just want to stay and just want to continue.
I was just in Savannah for Anne Craven has a beautiful show up at SCAD called 12 Moons. And I was chatting with a writer when I was there. And he said to me, you know, how do you deal with the question from clients? What's the investment value of this piece? And I always say, I want their grandchildren to be impressed that they bought this. I want their children to be impressed that they, you know what I mean? Like, of course, 5 years from now, things increase in value. That's wonderful. We want our artists to have museum shows, all of that. But what I really want is I want one or two generations ahead for their family to say, my God, I can't believe that you were there when this show happened.
And that it creates something of lasting cultural value and not only monetary value.
Absolutely. And what is the context that we're showing? If an artist is 35 years old, they're having tremendous market success, they're on the tip of everyone's tongue, that's wonderful. But who does their work relate back to? For every one of those artists, there's an artist 50 to 100 years ago that inspired their work that's probably not being recognized, shown,
absolutely,
collected as much as they should. So we've really made an effort to fold those artists into the program as well.
So it's kind of like ancient and modern. So you're looking at historical things, but also to the current generation.
Absolutely. I mean, a really great example is we've been fortunate to be able to work with Cassie Nimoda over the years. And when Cassie did her first show with us, she was a very young painter. She was fairly new to the materials. She had been a filmmaker. Over the years, she's gotten extraordinary recognition for her practice, and the work has grown in an exceptional way. Along that path, she said to me, you know, one of the people I looked at, he was a mentor to me. I worked for him when I first came to New York, is George Nelson Preston. So many people know George as a scholar, but since the 1950s, he's been making extraordinary paintings that deal with the African diaspora. You know, that is a huge marker to say this man was amongst the Ab-X artists. He was with the Beat Poets. He owned an alternative space in which Bob Dylan played one of his first shows. And all the while, he's been making these amazing paintings that have such direct threads to many artists, young artists that we're looking at today.
That is always standing on the shoulders of Gaians. And I think that's very important not to forget that we are inspired by so many things. And sometimes some people are just so early that the time was not ripe for them.
Exactly.
And they have to be seen again.
Exactly. That is the beauty of, for me, being in Miami, where the program can stretch broader in that way, because the galleries are not as specialized here. There's not as many here. And so we can have a context in which we show someone like Cassie and we also show someone like George.
And you also, in your own home, you live with art. And in another interview, you said something which I found also very interesting. It's like objects are enhanced by the lives around them. But also, I think the lives around are enhanced by objects, like by great art.
Absolutely. Both ways. I mean, that concept is really something that I get from Katie Stout, who largely has been focused her practice in more of a design lens. Really, she's a sculptor. I mean, the objects are functional, but when you ask her, why make this a light and not a sculpture? And her response was that she wanted the patina of life. She wants to see this object change and morph and become something else over time. And I think as much as that concept is really something that she's given me. And I think what you're saying is absolutely true, you know, that our children every day touch the nipple on the Katie Stout lamp to turn it on and turn it off. It's not lost on me that they're two little boys and that in some way that's affecting the people they will become, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, the art you're surrounded with, the way everybody else handles the art, the reaction on that, that are so subtle influences, even if we don't consciously remember, it definitely shapes the way we are. And we're coming back there to the stories that artworks tell, and also to the history and the charging of objects. So the next step for me would be to ask you about your presentation at Independent. What charged objects will you show there?
So we're really, you know, again, going back to this idea of being choosy and strategic about where we go. The Independent is a fair that I've always loved. I think Elizabeth and Matthew do such a great job because of who they are, you know, because of their intentions with the fair and because of what they know about what it means to be a dealer and what they know about the kinds of spaces artists want to show their work in. So this year we're bringing the work of Rob Davis. Rob is an artist originally from Virginia Beach who went to school in Chicago and makes extraordinary hyper-realist depictions of a 1970s America. He is in his 40s, and they're images that refer back to a blue-collar kind of idealized but also gritty reality about the American South. There's definitely nostalgia in them. I think there's longing in them. You know, there's definitely humor in them. You know, he brings in these sort of country music icons and pop culture references that can be a little bit funny. But I think also we're in a moment in this country where we're really questioning who we've become, mm-hmm. you know, like what is this collective American identity and how the loss of the perceived sense of Americana is being weaponized, you know, it's being used to turn people into sort of monstrous versions of themselves. And so I think Rob's work in this beautiful way just calls all of that to mind.
And what would you like to become if you look like in the next 5, 10, 20 years, not only as a gallery, but also as a person?
You know, I think our ambitions going forward are really, really about sustainability in every sense. You know, how do we make sure that we're continuing the ambitious program that we've had while truly supporting our artists in a long-term way amidst the market that's gotten hectic? We're continually focused on institutional acquisitions. So working with curators and museums to develop shows that, you know, that serve our artists in the length of their career. And then also just making sure that, you know, that I'm being fair to our staff, that everybody is getting the time that they need, the workload that's fair to them, you know, and same is true for myself, which is a difficult bar to match. There's so much to be done.
It's like you have a family, you have two sons, but you also said that you consider the artists also as part of an extended family. So if you deal with it on that level, there are other things probably you have to think about than only delivering or only functioning.
Well, that's the thing is like, when we look at the future for our artists, the kinds of things that concern me are, do they have the ability to own their studio? Mm-hmm. Do they have the ability to own their home? If they're women who want to have children, mm-hmm. is that possible for them? You know, I can't tell you how many artists over the years have said to me, you know, I want to have a family, but I don't see how that could possibly fit in. Is it going to hurt my career?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's so important, these discussions. Yeah.
And then also just, you know, with artists that we work with who are older, what do their estate plans look like? What does their retirement look like? You know, not retirement from making work, but retirement from feeling crunched by the pressures of their own practice. So when I talk about sustainability, that's really what I'm thinking about, you know, and I think largely the solutions lie in what has always been our strong suit, which is developing party relationships. You know, one of the things that we did recently was develop a partnership with 5 other dealers around the representation of Rochelle Feinstein. Mm-hmm. And that's been really a wonderfully fruitful thing because we all lean on each other heftily.
How did you do this? How did this come about? And how is the way you're communicating with each other?
You know, it was really Bridget Donahue's idea. Mm-hmm. And it stemmed from saying, if we're going to be representing an artist who is this established, has done so much in their career, and we're not blue chip galleries, mm-hmm. you know, we're not global enterprises, what do we have to offer her? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. how can we actually make the kind of impact that an artist of her stature deserves? And that was really where it was born. And I think the success of it has been, you know, again, it's that idea of self-selection, right? Mm-hmm. If any one of the partners was off or, I don't know, had ulterior motives, mm-hmm. Less honest, whatever you want to call it, it wouldn't work. But it works because everybody sees the same goalposts and is able to set their ego aside to work towards them. And unfortunately, I think that's relatively rare in our business.
Yes.
But when I talk about the future and thinking about sustainability, that's the kind of thing I'd like to be pushing for and working towards.
Yeah. I mean, that is like putting the ego aside requires so much integrity and transparency and honesty to work on that level together. I think it's something which is really required if you're not belonging to one of like the 10 super big galleries. I'm just wondering how this will work out in the future, if this is something which is more and more accepted, because I find it actually crucial.
My hope is that it will be, because I think we've all also been pretty bad at learning lessons from COVID, you know, like mm-hmm. we all sort of had this COVID time and we said, okay, we're not going to like jump back on this crazy travel thing. And we're not going to be doing every single art fair in the world. And we're going to be more strategic. And part of the way to do that is through partnership, right? Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to go open a gallery in LA, like every other gallery in the past year, you say, why don't I actually find a partner?
Yes.
Like Hannah Hoffman, who for nearly a decade has been invested in the community of Los Angeles, doing really great work there, and work with her, you know, instead of saying, I'm just going to show up and take from that, take from the work other people have done. I think those are the kinds of things that are sustainable.
Yeah. But true collaboration goes a step further, you know, because it's not unusual that galleries like so-called work together and share artists, but true collaboration is kind of like the next step.
Totally, totally. And it fundamentally benefits everyone, you know, especially the artists.
And what would be your wish for the conversations and everything at Independent?
You know, our hope with bringing Rob's work to Independent is that his peers and the people that he's been working alongside for so long are really able to see and appreciate what he's been up to. He's such a dedicated artist and has an incredibly serious practice. And I feel that people know him, but I'm not sure they truly understand the depth of the work yet. So we saw towards that with the solo show that he had at the gallery last year. And I just feel that bringing him into the context of New York will really help push that conversation forward in a major way.
Nina, thank you so much. I wish you all the best for that.
Thank you.
This was a special Voices on Art episode created in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York. Listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice. On our website, van-horn.net. And in the Independent OVR at independenthq.com. Follow Independent Art Fair on Instagram at independent_HQ and the podcast at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.